Good evening and welcome tonight to our meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you are in the know. I am Richard Rubin, a member of the Commonwealth Board of Governors, Commonwealth Club's Board of Governors, and your chair for this program. You can find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org or download the iPhone and Android apps for the programs, and you can schedule and for schedule information and podcasts of all of our past programs as well. Let me mention that tonight's program is part of the club's Good Lit series that has been underwritten by the Bernard Osher Foundation. We thank them very, very much. Now it is my pleasure to introduce today's speaker, Maurice Kanbar, noted inventor, philanthropist, and author of the newly updated version of his 2001 book, Secrets from an Inventor's Notebook. I am also very pleased to call Maurice a good friend. Long before there was the TV series Shark Tank, there was Maurice Kanbar. Maurice has been called a modern Buckminster Fuller, and he has accumulated over 41 patents, 41, in four decades of inventing. His creations include the D-Fuzz It Sweater Comb, a customizable sticky notes device called Zip Notes, Sky Vodka, and its successor, Blue Angel. They're both very good. The first nation's first multiplex movie theaters, which happen to be in New York City. Durable eyeglasses, which he donates, 50,000 or more, as I recall, and going up, to people in developing countries. Very extra-safe children's toys, organically manufactured foods, a caviar, and much, much more. In 2006, Maurice actually produced his first feature film. Maybe some of you saw it. It was the animated film called Hoodwinked, followed by Hoodwinked 2, its sequel, Hood vs. Evil. Maurice is also well known for his charitable contributions from the Kanbar Cardiac Center at California Pacific Medical Center in San Francisco to New York University's Kanbar Film School to the internationally renowned San Francisco Girls Chorus, whose performing arts center on Page Street bears his name. Maurice was born and reared in Brooklyn. His roots were not wealthy ones. His parents owned a small laundry. He had to make it on his own, and he early on learned the value of saving. For example, Maurice never worries about paying large sums to go into parking lots. Why? Well, you could see him instead riding around on his trademark red scooter all around town. Doesn't take up that lot of space. Some years ago, Maurice told an interviewer about a Charlie Chaplin film that he particularly liked, which was entitled Limelight. At one point, the great actor, who was then only a young boy in the film, is walking past a toy shop, and he exclaims to his father, "Hey, Dad, look at that wonderful toy," knowing that they could not possibly afford it. Chaplin's father looks at the boy in the film, points to his head, and says, "This is the greatest toy ever given man." Maurice never forgot that, and today we are the better for it. He has gone on to write his own story several times over. His energy and enthusiasm, frankly, are contagious. Maurice holds a degree in engineering from Philadelphia University, which also awarded him an honorary degree, along with another that he received from Kenyon College in Ohio, which it just so happens is my own alma mater. He has quite clearly put his education to good use. Today, Maurice will be in conversation with Dr. Mary Bitterman, who is past chair of the Commonwealth Club's Board of Governors, president of the Bernard Osher Foundation, and the chair of the PBS Foundation. Would you please give a rousing welcome to Maurice Kanbar, a truly Renaissance man?
at this point, you'd say genug ist genug.
Genug, genug. You know,
that was
genug
such a gracious introduction, but every piece of it so well scripted and so true. The thing I want to start off with is, and I should disclose the fact that I know you.
Yes.
All right. There's something about your upbringing, and I think sort of a moat around you of a certain kind of unconditional love, which I think principally was directed to you by your mother, who thought you were perfection completed.
Do you
want to just say a word about what it was like growing up in Brooklyn? Your parents have a small laundry. You have two brothers, Elliot, one of my favorite names, Elliot and Edward. And so, say a word about Brooklyn.
Brooklyn was a beautiful place. My first job at the age of 12 was working in a drugstore because I was a small, skinny kid, and I didn't want to work at the supermarket because I'd have to carry big packages and help older people. This right here, prescription was something I put in my pocket, deliver it, and in those
days... Did you ride a scooter then?
No, a bicycle. No. I pedaled a bike, and if you got a nickel tip, that was going fine. If you got a dime tip, that was a big tipper. There was one guy that gave a quarter tip.
Oh, my gosh.
And that was a lot of money, and I couldn't wait for him to get sick again, you know? So it was really lovely. And my parents, who were not Orthodox Jews, decided the best school to send me to was a yeshiva. And I hated it at the time, but today I realize that was a very wonderful thing that they did. I didn't like it because I had to get in at 8:30 till 4:30 when the other kids went to school from 9 to 3. Well, why do I have to? Anyway, it worked out. It was a wonderful
thing. Did your brothers go to the yeshiva as
well? Oh, yeah. Three of us went to the yeshiva. And you see, again, they were very dedicated to making sure that their kids are going to go to college out of town. And again, it was just as expensive then as it is now, even though it was only $2,000 a year. Well, the subway fare was a nickel. It's now $2.50.
Yeah, and a big tip was 10 cents.
Of what's happened, you know, to the value of money. But we all went. They all did very well at school. My brothers did better than I did. That is for grades, you know. But I've always, you know, had a little inventive or maybe if I needed to get something, I would do it. Somebody said, what was your first invention? I said, the kid next door in Brooklyn, his mother bought him a bow and arrow. And I said, Mommy, I'd like to have a bow and arrow. I'm like 12. There's no bow and arrows. No, forget it. They never bought me toys. So I said, God, I want a bow and arrow. So we had a little backyard with some trees, and I looked for a long, straight branch. I cut the branch, tied a piece of string, bent it over, made my own bow and arrow, okay? Hey, now I could play, and I had, look, I got it. I think it was working better than his purchased bow and arrow. So things like that, I think, start at a very young age. I mean, my brothers didn't have it, but, you know, I did.
You were just always curious.
I've been blessed. I think, I've been blessed. It's not that I work harder. It's that, you know, things come to me. I'll explain it when I explain some of these things. Because it isn't a matter of working harder. It's a matter of doing the right thing, the right sequences.
And being inquisitive.
Being?
Inquisitive.
Well,
constantly.
As a matter of, you know,
asking questions.
If you look at a two-year-old and you want to determine the two-year-old's IQ, how do you do that? You measure curiosity. You show them something, you see how long is the kid involved, and, the kid, blah, blah, you know, and then you convert that to IQ. So if you have the curiosity, you will certainly learn. If you don't have the curiosity, then okay, everything's okay. Teach me. Anyway.
I think it's wonderful that you've brought some demonstrations. Yeah. Now, the people on radio will not be able to see these things, but
okay,
we'll try to describe them so well that they'll feel
Okay,
a tactile sensation. We want to begin with the defuzzer.
Okay, well, this is my
first... How did this come about?
This is my first invention, okay? I was at a dude ranch with my college roommate, and I was wearing a sweater, and my back was against a concrete wall. And he said, come on down to the bar. There's some very nice girls. And I've seen them. No, come on. And he pulled me. And as he pulled me, I looked at the... I said, wait a minute. And I saw two fuzzballs on the concrete. I said, what the hell is going on here, you know? Well, I said, forget it. Go. I'm not going. And I thought about it. And I said, I realized what had happened, that the sand in the concrete was able to grab one of the fuzzballs on my sweater and took it right off. So when I went home, I bought some coarse fabric, a quarter of a yard, and then I bought some adhesive, and I put the adhesive on, and then sprinkled sand over it, basically it's almost like sandpaper, and I waited for it to dry and then folded it, and lo and behold, on a sweater, it removed the fuzzballs, and the ones that were not too tight, it opened the fuzzballs. Now, there's a difference. Some of these new fuzzball removers cut the fuzzballs off. What happens eventually is that the loft, the fibers that stick out, are all cut, and the cashmere doesn't have the same soft feel. But with defuzz it, you know what I mean? I put that right here. We originally, it cost us 7 cents to make this with the card, and we sold it for $1. So we made about 40, 50 cents for each one we sold. I didn't have much money. What we did was we took two of these and mailed it to Notion stores and said, we are a small company. We can't afford to send a representative to see you, but we think we have a nice product. And cut along the dotted line and send this order, 3 dozen, 6 dozen, 12 dozen. And we got orders. And the reason why I said cut along the dotted line, because to perforate that, they wanted $60.
Oh, forget it.
Okay. I said cut along the dotted line. And the first 14 months, we made $220,000. At a time, at that point, the subway fare in New York was 10 cents. It's now 250, so that's 25 times. $220,000 was like making $2 million. It was fabulous, okay? I bought a house on 77th Street between 5th and Madison for $247,000, 25-foot limestone building. It's worth, I don't know, $20 million. Mind-boggling. Anyway, so that was my first invention. I finally decided to go on, you know, so I sold this to the kid that I invited to come in. He lost his job. Anyway, he's still making money because I got involved with some other things. Anyway.
Why don't we talk a little bit about, and it's very interesting, and I recommend this book to all of you who want to go into the innovation business. Maurice is very clear about asking questions, thinking about whether or not what you want to do sort of makes sense. But naming and branding is extremely important. You're Quad Cinema. And you have to remember that Maurice Kanbar is really, in earlier lives, was obviously a filmmaker. He obviously owned studios all over the world. He led a life so rich in film because now in this iteration of his life, he's been so involved with film societies. He goes to Cannes every year. He's produced films. He has endowed the film school at NYU. And he's done this wonderful program for KQED called Film School Shorts, where some extraordinary films from 9 exceedingly prestigious film schools are curated and presented across the United States to PBS member stations, including 30 of the major markets. So say a word about how you decided to come up with Quad Cinema.
Okay, well, I was having dinner with somebody who came from Chicago, and he was telling me his grandfather built some wonderful movie houses, and the movie business was now terrible, and this is 1971. So I said, gee, I go to the movies all the time. I don't understand. I said, well, this is people are watching television and whatnot. Anyway, so I walked into actually Lowe's 85th Street. It was a 1,500-seat house. And I counted the house. There was 120 people there. I said, my God, the poor guy is going broke. But I made a determination that people in the movie business, in the exhibition business, did not really understand. And that was, things had gotten worse in terms of people paying to come to the movies, but some people still wanted to go to the movies. Well, I realized, I said, whatever, you show a film, so many warm bodies will show up. They don't care how big the theater was. It's a long story. I accidentally owned some property on 13th Street in Manhattan. And I said, you know, I could build 450-seat houses, and if each one pulls 100 people, I'm doing great. Anyway, I did that, and it worked beautifully. And we were profitable the first month. And everybody looked at this, my God, that's right. You know, you don't have to build a big 1,500-seat house. Or if you have a 1,500-seat, you go broke. But then let's see if we can cut it up and make it into small. But nobody thought of building four little movie houses under one roof. So there it was. And to me, once you think about it, I didn't think it was brilliant. I said, I made a determination, you know what I mean? Show a film, so many warm bodies will show up. Because going to a theater is an event. And I always say, look, it has something to do with sex. How many things have to do with sex? I mean, look, the guy wants Mary to stay over tonight. So he calls her up and says, hi, sweetheart, I got a great film on DVD. Come on over. He says, forget it, I'm not doing it. So he says, Mary, I'll take you for a hamburger, and we're going to see a movie. Then we can go home. It's okay. Hello? I mean, what? It's not rocket science, okay?
Okay.
We still
now, before
have people,
Maurice makes everything sound just so elementary and so simple that any one of us in this room and anyone in the audience could come up with these very smart ideas. Let me just ask you to say a few words about 80-20. Oh, come on.
All right, well, now, not everything that I've done was a big hit. I mean, I have had a few, but, you know, one I'll give you, which I thought was going to be fabulous. I didn't do my homework. Okay. Anyway, I had a young lady who said, I did a favor, she said, I'm taking you to lunch. I said, okay. It was Sunday, she takes me to lunch. She drives into a Burger King. I said, I don't want a burger. What is this? This is lunch? She says, oh, Sunday, the rest of them are closed. Like, come on out. I follow her into Burger King. This is my first time Burger King. She says, order the chicken McNuggets. Oh, chicken tenders. McNuggets is from McDonald's. Anyway, I said, okay, so what do you want to drink? I said, I want to drink Diet Coke because I want to cut down on my sugar intake. She says, okay. I'm saying, what is it, sir? I said, I want a Diet Coke. I got an empty cup. She says, over there. I said, okay. I didn't know what the routine was. And I said, Carolyn, look at this. This is America. Regular Coke, Diet Coke, Sprite, Schmite, Dr. Pepper, Mrs. Jackson, whatever. I said, you have choices. I said, wait a minute, let me try this. I said, I want Diet Coke. Okay. I put in about 20% regular Coke, sugar Coke, and 80% Diet Coke, stirred it. And I said, Carolyn, look at this. You can't taste the aspartame. This tastes perfectly like it's 100% sugar. And I said, boy, I went home, I did it, I bought Diet, I bought regular Coke, I was mixing. I said, this is a great item. I said, I've got it. We're going to make 80-20 cola. I said, great. There was a very sharp kid, the son of a friend of mine. I said, Russ, I said, I'm going to hire you. He just run for office and lost. Anyway, he says, yeah, very, very sharp kid. So I said, okay, Russ, we're going to do this, blah, blah. And I didn't do my homework, okay? We showed it to Safeway. Safeway says, we're going to give you a corner, you know, display. It's terrific. We love it. What a great idea, 80-20 goal. We did it, and then I got to study what was really happening. I said, wait a minute. On a six-pack of Coca-Cola, diet or otherwise, Coke makes 12 cents. I thought they make a dollar, so I can make a half a dollar. You know? I said, that was the first bad thing. And then 80-20 cola could not be patented. Okay? I said, Russ, you know, I made a big mistake. First, there's not enough money profit. Secondly, I said, if we're successful, at Safeway, you can be sure that Coke and Pepsi are going to knock us off, and we won't have a chance to compete. So all I can tell you is I'm closing it down. I'll take a, whatever, $250,000, $300,000 loss. I'm going to give you a month, and that's it. The end of the story was, he said to me, you know, came back 2 days later, he said, you know, I'd like to make an energy drink. I said, that's a very good idea, because same 8-ounce thing, they get $2. Red Bull gets $2. Sure. And by that time, he understood the business that you can get contract people to make whatever you want, okay? Make an energy drink with caffeine, taurine, whatever. You can make it. And make it taste better. Make it taste better than Red Bull. I said, but you got to get a good name, Ross, because to me, your name is very important. I got a great name. I said, what? He says, my name is Rockstar. Rockstar Energy Drink. I said, Rockstar? Who the hell wants to drink a Rockstar? Okay? So I didn't invest. I said, no, I'll help you, whatever you want, blah, blah. I said, good luck. No, it's a great name. People love Rockstar. I don't like Rockstar. Well, to make a long story short, he turned down an offer of $1 billion for the brand. So that's how smart I am. So anyway, you don't hit home runs, but you can't be discouraged.
No, but
you have to continue.
There's a wonderful part in Maurice's book where he's talking about naming, and you've really got to brand things properly. He was reflecting on something he had read, that in 1909, a hair product came out, the first hair dyeing product, and it was called French Harmless Hair Dye. But within a year, the company decided they would rebrand and was called L'Oreal. So the point that Maurice is making is that, you know, here you knew that the product was not just safe, but glamorous. I think that's really very sweet. Now, what you have to know as just some background, Maurice feels very strongly that you need to ask yourself these questions as you go into the inventive process. Is what you want to bring to market more environmentally friendly or durable? Is it less costly or time-consuming? Is it safer or easier to use? Is it smaller or quieter? Is it more comfortable or attractive? So with that in mind, can you say a few words about that which was initially called Roll-It?
Well, no, I mean, look, if I get a little upset about something, I think about it. I got down to the last four pages of Post-it notes, and I'm blowing out to finally separate. And I said to myself, there's got to be a better way to do Post-it notes in these stupid little pads. So I thought about it. I said, wait a minute. I got it. I'm going to put Post-it notes on a roll and have it delivered electrically, very simple. And I called it Roll It. So anyway, 3M, they own Post-it notes. They said, you can't use the word Roll It. I said, why? It is our name. I said, don't be crazy. So they go to court. We had a judge.
No, but didn't you do something like Post It? No, Roll It.
No. The reason why I called it Roll It is I was going to say, don't post it, roll it.
Okay? I think that's probably what I said to him a little bit. Yeah.
So we go to court. And the judge looks at me and says, you know, they own Post-it, and you want to call it Roll-It? I don't know. I said, Your Honor, in 1962, I did my first invention, and I called it Defuzz It. So if anybody owns it, it's me.
Would you like to demonstrate this to the audience? Explain so that radio audience people feel
okay,
that they're with us right here.
It's on a roll. The adhesive is in the center. You press a button, and the motor lets you take it out. And since the adhesive is in the middle, you know how Post-it note curls. This lays flat. And if you want a shorter piece, just say, Harry, call me. I don't know how to use a 3x. Whoops. Anyway, there it is. And again, you can move it, put it over here. You know, it's a sticky note, okay? But it works so easily. I have it on my desk. I use it all the time. Just press a button, tear it off, okay?
And you can have a really long piece.
So I said to if you want. If you have what we call a Megillah, I mean, you know, hey.
You could write Evangeline if you wanted
to. Okay, there it is. And here, we'll put this on the back of my card here. Sticks perfectly, you know. So it's an efficient and inexpensive way because most of the time, you don't want to use a 3x3 note. So if you use a 1.5x3 note, you're saving 50%. And post-it notes are not cheap. They're like at least a penny a 3x3, each piece. You know? And then the guys were doing some, they stopped it, but the pads, they sell 5 pads. And you look clever, all of a sudden the pad is 90 sheets instead of 100 sheets per pad. I don't do things like that. But anyway, so I thought this was a good thing. The judge says to me, well, I don't know, you may have done this. I'm real crazy. He says, I would like to listen to, no, I'm not going to dismiss their suit against you. You can't use roll it because I want to listen to some expert witnesses to tell me what it is. I said, Your Honor, they will hire an expert witness who will tell you there's tremendous confusion. I will hire a witness and say, there's no confusion, okay? Because I pay an expert witness who will do that. I says, you will make the ultimate decision. He didn't like me. He says, no, I want to listen. I want to listen to the expert witness. And to make a long story short, rather than go to court forever, they wrote a check out for him. It's a nice sum. I said, all right, I'll drop the name, roll it. I'll call it Zip Notes. And that's what I have. And it's called Zip Notes. And I'd love to find somebody who can go out there and sell it. I don't have the time. I have.
See, that's the problem.
Well, anyway,
you don't have the time. I know, you're just...
It should sell itself.
Okay, I want to go into just a couple of more things, and then we're going to raise people's questions because people really want to do what you're doing.
Go, sure.
And to do it as successfully. All right, and then once hugely successful, then they can be a munificent benefactor.
Why not?
Like you. So
I think it's wonderful.
I want to get on to the business of saying to oneself, I want to have a little alcoholic content, but I don't want to have a headache. So why don't you share that story that led to the invention of Sky, SKYY?
Okay, yeah,
vodka.
Again, it's common sense in my book. I didn't think this was rocket science. Anyway, I went to my yearly physical of years like 91 or 92, and my doctor says to me, listen, you don't look well. Don't you feel well? I said, I have a hangover. He said, what were you drinking? I said, I was drinking very good cognac. He said, stay away from cognac. Just drink vodka. I said, why? Just drink vodka. I said, okay. Sanity, you're okay. So I switched to vodka. Now, I like to have a drink. I like the buzz. And, you know, I'm not an alcoholic, but I like the buzz. I had a martini for lunch, you know, and I have a martini for lunch. I didn't have another drink. I said, anyway, so I got this headache. And now I switched to vodka, and lo and behold, I only get a headache like 1 of 4, 1 of 5, 1 of 5 times, but not every time as I do with cognac. That was interesting. And then about 6 months later, I'm having dinner with my doctor, who happens to be a personal friend, my internist. We're celebrating a friend's birthday. We were at a restaurant in New York. And I said, just give me a vodka on the rocks, because I found that it didn't matter what brand. 1 out of 4 times I'd get a headache. Anyway, so the guy paused me. And said, it's okay, I had a drink. And the bartender, he says, yeah, give him another drink. We're having another drink. I said, no, have another. I don't drink 2 drinks. Okay, I had 2 drinks. And I said, Martin, the second drink today, I've got a headache. What the hell is happening? I usually don't. He says, this alcohol had a high congener content. I said, what the hell is a congener? I just take an aspirin. How do you spell that? I always put it in my pocket. I went home. I have an unabridged dictionary. There's no such thing as a conjurer. Okay. I get back to San Francisco. I said, I'm going to go to the medical library. I know he's not crazy. And I learned something, okay? I'll do it as fast as I can. But anyway, if you take any carbohydrate and add yeast, you could ferment it. During the fermentation, that carbohydrate turns to alcohol. If you use sugar cane, the alcohol is called rum. If you use grapes, the alcohol is called brandy. If you use corn, the alcohol is called vodka. But it's all the same thing, the fermentation to ethyl alcohol. Nature produces a damn good ethyl alcohol. It's about 98-99% pure ethyl alcohol with 1-2% congeners. Congeners are naturally forming impurities. Now, the alcohol we drink is ethyl alcohol. The 1-2% of congeners are propyl alcohol, acetaldehyde, ethyl formate, amyl alcohol, a lot of chemical junk. And it's this chemical junk that gives bourbon or cognac its flavor. Okay, now that's very interesting. Next time I was in New York, I went back to the same restaurant. I says, give me a vodka neat. And I said, fine, I took one of those little airline bottles and I poured it in there and closed it. And the bartender says, what are you doing? I said, I'm going to a party, they don't drink, I just pour this into the orange juice. Oh, very smart. He didn't say, why didn't you do this at home, you idiot? You know, anyway, instead of spending $8 for it. Anyway, so, and what I did, I sent it to a lab because I wanted to find out. Lo and behold, the lab report has a high content of amyl alcohol. I said, I now know what it is. I'm sensitive to amyl alcohol. It gives me a damn bad headache. Anyway, I know enough about chemistry to know you can't filter out these impurities. You must distill at precise temperatures to remove the fractions. Okay, I happen to know that. Okay. As I calculated, you need 4 distillations. To make a long story, I find a distiller, and I said, this is what I want. I want a vodka, but I want it to be distilled 4 times. And the guy said, are you crazy? We've been making alcohol have vodka for 120 years. Nobody has asked for 4 distillations. I said, I want it to be still 4 distillations. He said, I don't know. I finally said, and this is after one guy finally said, all right, I'll do it. I said to me, CBD. I said, CB, what? What is that? Cash before delivery. I said, okay. And when the check clears, we'll make it for you. All right. Make a long sent it to him, check cleared, made it, you know what I mean? And it turned out, and I tweaked it with my own little tricks that I used. And I was able to get a patent for it. And then at the last moment, I said, here's another interesting thing. The last moment, I said to my patent attorney, I said, Michael, I don't want the patent to issue. He said, why not? Is it driven? No, I don't want the patent to issue. He said, why? I said, I don't know how to protect it. If I tell other people what I'm doing, then one way or another, they're going to copy it. Go find them or what? I can't do it, okay? And that was a perfectly intelligent decision to make not to get a patent, okay? So I didn't get a patent. I kept it a secret. And I don't think to this day they don't know exactly what I'm doing, but they know it's pure at all. Now every other guy is doing 4 distillations, 8 distillations. Anyway, we made a terrific vodka, and it was called Sky Vodka. And there again, name to me is very important. May I go on?
Yes, as no, an example, I want you to explain
as an
how
example,
you chose
as a
Sky.
Rich, rich Russian, he spent $25 million to do a vodka that he sells in Russia, and it's called Russian Standard Vodka. Now, in Russia, it works well. Give me a Russian Standard on the rock. In America, it's a stupid call. So after $25 million, it's still not selling. There's nobody. Give me a Russian Standard on the rocks. You sound like an idiot. You know? So,
and right
the
now,
name
it doesn't even sound
very,
congenial.
Very important, okay?
Yeah.
Well, when I did Sky, the first name that popped in my head, I'm going to call it Prince Romanov Vodka. I have a Prince Romanov on the rocks. No. How about Tsar Nikolai? But hey, wait a minute. It's not going to be Russians. It's going to be Americans. So another 3 months went by. I was very lucky. I looked out the window. We had a beautiful blue. I said, look at that sky. You have to be lucky also. I said, that's Sky Vodka. I called my patent. I said, Michael, I want to register this name. What? Sky vodka. How do you spell it? Sky, S-K-Y. No good. He said, what do you mean no good? Too generic. That's too generic. It's like, you want to register air or water? Sky? Shit. Sorry.
No, this is public radio. Yeah.
That's on the radio. Yeah, I don't want to say that.
Okay, we can bleep.
They can bleep that.
We can bleep.
They can bleep that. I mean, every movie I go to, the guys are using the F word.
No, I know. No, not now. Not now, Maurice. Not
anyway,
now.
Anyway, okay.
Okay.
Oh, God.
Okay. So then you said, well, just
so
to add
Sky
another
said,
Y.
So, well, no. Then I took them 2 weeks. And I said, wait a minute. I'll add another Y.
Yeah.
It turned
Perfect.
Out to be a blessing.
Yeah.
Because it gave it a great look. It says, you also have to be lucky. Okay? So I said, Sky, and I went out and sold it. That was a huge success. And I put it, I said, how'd you get a blue bottle? Said, what are you going to put Sky Vodka in, a yellow bottle? I mean, you know, I'm just like, you got to be a genius to figure out to put in a blue bottle.
Okay. Well, now, before we go on to these wonderful questions.
We may be here till midnight. You know?
Yeah. No. We're just getting started. And I think it's very sweet when you read the book that you'll see that Maurice says, you know, there's the Russian stuff, there's the Swedish stuff, but this is really going to be American vodka. And he doesn't put on it, made in America. No. He says, distilled in America from American grain. So, I mean, the whole thing is
that
really...
That took a couple of months.
Yeah,
how can
the gestalt
I say
is perfect.
Made in America?
Okay.
Made with pride. I don't know.
But then slipping over to Europe...
Yeah.
We're talking about this wonderful painter whose work you've always enjoyed, Vermeer. And you say to yourself, wow, I think if the Irish can do something, and of course I'm Irish, so, you know, but we're still good friends, that the Bailey's cream you thought was kind of interesting, but you wanted to come up with something very special with a very special chocolate. So tell us a little bit about Vermeer.
Well, I was talking to some... people in Holland who are in the dairy business. And I said, you know, I want to make a chocolate cream liqueur to compete with Bailey's. I said, we can do it. You know, sorry. And I want, Bailey's uses an Irish whiskey as a base alcohol. I would be using vodka because it's cleaner. It doesn't have a whiskey taste to it. Okay. Anyway, we experiment this, that, do that, do that. Anyway, we made a very, very nice chocolate cream liqueur. Unfortunately, by that time, I was too busy with Sky and didn't devote the kind of time that it deserved. It's still there. If there's anybody here that wants to sell or promote Vermeer, the Dutch chocolate cream liqueur, I'd be very happy to talk to them, okay? My number is in the phone book, okay? So we have not made, that has not been a success because it's just been ignored.
But at the beginning, it looked as though everything was very auspicious. You were wondering about whether or not enough people knew about Vermeer, and then the movie came out, and then there were exhibitions across the country, and you had on your label the wonderful girl with the pearl earring.
Yeah, that's a masterpiece by Vermeer.
Absolutely.
It's called The Girl with the Pearl Earring, often referred to as the Dutch Mona Lisa.
Exactly.
Okay?
Exactly.
Beautiful
and we had
painting.
It here just
it's a beautiful
last year.
And it's very easy to sell. All you have to do is tasting. It takes a lot of time and work, but we go into a liquor store and have tasting. In the States, that's permitted. We get orders and get reorders. But it's been, again, management is key. Unless you manage it properly, I don't care what business you're in, you're going to lose money, okay? And it has not been managed right. Somebody should turn the air conditioner on. Yeah, you know, it's gotten very warm. Okay.
Okay, you can use one of these cards as a fan.
Okay, yeah,
but
okay.
Don't keep it near your mic. Yeah, but keep it there on the right. So people are very interested in your inventions, but are interested in knowing if there are a few inventions of other people that you think were quite or are quite smart. There are a few that you mentioned in the book, as a matter of fact.
Yeah.
Like
who are we talking about, huh?
Like good grips. Good grips.
Did I mention that?
Remember?
I don't know.
There was a gentleman whose wife, that's because you're on information overload and just too inventive. But one of the things that Maurice mentions in the book, you know, the OXO good grips, is that the gentleman's wife had some sort of arthritis of the hands.
Exactly. That was brilliant.
You know? So, yeah, speak to it because, yeah.
Oh, well, look. Always look at a problem and say, what can I do about it? I says, older people, they don't have the grip, whatever. So I said, I can put a large rubber handle on it, call it good grips. And he was very successful.
They made, in the book, I think you mentioned 850 implements within the family of good grips.
Right, good grips. Okay, I mean, expanded. But based on one simple thing, an observation that many people can't hold on to, make it so that people can hold on to it. Brilliant, you know. It doesn't have to be rocket science to be successful.
So, a question here that you actually answer in some detail in your book, but to whet the appetite of people, what is the difference between an inventor who has a great idea and goes nowhere and a successful entrepreneur?
Okay, well, I use as an example for that. John and Mary are driving, and it's drizzling. This is 15 years ago. He turns the wiper on, turns it off, turns the wiper on, turns. He says, Mary, you know what they should have? You should have a button, press a button, and you'd have an intermittent wiper. Wouldn't that be a great invention? Oh, John, great invention. Okay. 10 years later, he buys a car, and lo and behold, it has an intermittent wiping. Turn intermittent wiping. And he says, Mary, didn't I invent that? I said, no, you didn't invent it. You've got to go one step further. A lot of people have a good idea, but they don't carry through with the idea. So I'm saying you have to think and say, what could I do? Now you say, but I'm mechanically incapable of doing this. Find somebody who's mechanically capable and say, Jack, I want you to design a wiper that works, you know, intermittently. And you can find that person. It's not rocket science. And you'd have an invention. And the guy that... that happens to be an interesting story because the guy that did invent that ended up collecting millions of dollars from General Motors, Ford, and Chrysler. This is very interesting. He invented a mechanical system using what is known as a cam to do this, okay? When General Motors and Ford and Chrysler made an intermittent wiper, they used it electronically. Very different. And they could have not only just intermittent, excuse me, but variable intermittent. It could be this, this, or it could be. You know, it was, I don't think that they infringed on the man's patent. He had to make that. But the jury awarded him millions of dollars, okay? So, but the point is that if you have an idea like that, carry it, go a step further, go. You know, look, you might have an idea. Look here, post-it note. You say, gee, I hate this pad. How the hell, what can I do? All I said was, put it on a roll. Okay, and look, put it on a roll. How do I find this adhesive, right? Oh, it's a big deal. No, I don't know if you've seen it, but very often you get a letter, and there's a strip with a barcode on it. Take that strip off, put it, it's got a removable adhesive that you can place any place else. Who did I call? I called the guys that make that for the post office. I said, can you make a roll for me? Oh, yeah, you pay for it, we'll make it, you know. So there it is, and there's the roll. As you can see, the radio audience can't see, but it's nothing to it. It's a roll. I want it 3 inches so that I can call. See, press the... See, press this. Now you've got a 3x3 note. Easy as pie, okay? So, again, you've got to think about it. Where do you find a guy to make this adhesive? Oh, because 3M says, we're geniuses. That's why we made this adhesive. Well, there are other geniuses out there, you know? They're not the only geniuses. Anyway, there it is. What's the next question?
Okay, and I just returned from St. Paul, so this is really very connected. Do you think it's more complicated, more difficult for a new idea to take off today in a more populous high-tech age?
Well, I'm very sorry that I'm not 30 years old, because if I was, I don't know, I looked at WhatsApp was sold and the guy got $19 billion. I couldn't believe it. I still don't understand it, okay? So I'm sure that if I were 30 years old, I would figure out something with some app or something. I'm not saying I get $19 billion, but I got $100 million for an app, okay? So I feel deprived and out of the loop, okay? Because I don't know that. So
in the book, just for example, the description you give of all of the extraordinary features that can be developed with 3D printing.
Well, first, number one, I'm very cautious about words. Does everybody here know what a 3D printer is? Okay. About
the audience, okay. For those who can't
that's,
see,
that's the wrong
tend to
designation.
Be nodding their heads.
It is not a 3D printer. It is a 3D model maker, not a printer. I mean, you ask yourself, what's a 3D? It prints 3D? You don't even know. It's a 3D model maker. We don't get into how it works, but brilliant. You know, I love it. We have it. I mean, I have a 3D printer in the office, you know, so that if we want to make a little model, we can make it. It's beautiful.
Okay. People want to know what you're inventing now.
Well, there's one invention I can't even talk about, and I think I mentioned that to you.
Okay. Well, just know that Maurice is still at it.
There's always look, here, I've invented something that I will not make a penny, and I hope to do some good. I was reading where in the third world, there are a lot of people that are myopic, nearsighted. You show much E, okay? They can't afford a pair of glasses or whatnot. I'm sorry I didn't bring them here.
No, they're wonderful. Yeah.
So I made a strip with 2, 3, 4, 5 diopters. That's the strength of the lens. So, okay, you say, Mr. Gallabucci, look at the E, right? Oh, I see the next one. Oh, I see that. I see the last one. No, that one. No, this one. Okay. So we know in the left eye, 3 diopters, the right eye, 4 diopters. Here's a pair of glasses. The guy can now see, okay? And it's virtually to his prescription, okay? Because the left eye maybe need a higher diopter, the right eye. What does it cost? 85 cents with the lenses. And we've given away over 50,000, but I'm trying to get, if anybody here knows Gates, we give it to him, I'd be very happy to get help. All I'm going to do is give them, the molds are all paid for. So I'll give you the guy in China, and you can order the glasses, whatever you want. There's a kit that we make with the lenses and the frame. And you're in business. And it's very easy to pop the lens in the frame. And it's I call it the Sigmund Freud frame. They're 2 round discs, or the Albert Einstein. Years ago, they all wore these simple round glasses.
Like your friend Bernard.
Huh?
Yeah. All right. How do you know your inventions have not been invented before?
You don't know. What you have to do is what is known as a search, a patent search. Today, with the computer, you can get an awful lot of information in the computer and say, oh, somebody has invented this, right? Okay. So you don't have to spend a lot of money for legal fees.
Mm-hmm. Which is smart and which you wouldn't want to do. What have you enjoyed most about your work and what have you enjoyed least?
Well, of course, the successful inventions are always very pleasurable, okay? 80-20 cola was, I thought, a disaster, okay? I made a mistake, and there it is. I wrote the check out, and it was a loss, okay? But again, you can't be discouraged to the point where you stop working, you know? So still keep thinking. And I've done a number of things after that, you know?
What do you think about some of these crowdfunding sources like Kickstarter for people who want to bring inventions forward?
Well, you know, again, the first thing you have to do is think, get upset if it doesn't work right, okay? Whatever you do. The young kids today can say, what upsets you about your iPad, you know? If it upsets you, say, how can I do it better? Or what could I do to make it better, okay? And then there's a chance that you can make it better and get a patent and also be able to make a lot of money without having a 9-to-5 job. Okay? Does that more or less answer it? I'm not answering it fully, let's repeat the question.
No, you did. What? There are a number of questions, but they all go back to this. And you've answered, but I think it's worth addressing it again. What motivates you? What has led to your being this inventive person?
I really think you're born with it, okay? I don't think you can make it, but I think you're born with it. And I was saying, I think somebody just an hour ago or so, I said, you know, like, if you want to check a two-year-old's IQ, you can't ask them questions, okay? But you check their curiosity. And the more curious that child is, the higher his IQ, because he's going to learn more. Now, a lot of smart people understand a lot of what's going on, but most people don't care about making an improvement. I get very frustrated. I say, perfect example. I get the last pad, three sheets, and I couldn't separate it. I said, there's got to be a better way than a pad. And I put it on a roll. Okay? It's not. Once you see it, well, no, it's not rocket science. But you have to think about it. Okay? And, yeah, it's there's a need. There's a need. Oh, look, I would say the invention that I'm most proud of, which you haven't asked me, right, but I will tell
no,
you.
No, but it's here.
Is it in there?
You're anticipating,
Maurice.
Oh, okay.
Maurice. All right. Well,
you're anticipating.
Ask me and I'll tell you. Okay.
All right, but I'm just going. All right, but I'm just going to take 1 second to remind people who may have just tuned into the radio program that you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Today, our guest is noted inventor and philanthropist Maurice Canbar. I'm Mary Bitterman. You can also find video of Commonwealth Club programs online at the club's YouTube channel. So, what are you the most proud of,
The
Maurice?
Invention that I'm most proud of, 20 years ago, the same internist, who's a dear friend, the same internist that told me about congeners, said to me, calls me up and says to me, you know, Maurice, let me tell you something. Last year, there were 20,000 accidental needle sticks.
Yes.
Okay?
Yes, this is so important.
He says, yes, in hospitals, clinics, and whatnot. And he says, you know, if you're dealing with a patient with AIDS or hepatitis, you now have it. It's that easy, okay? And this is terrible. You got HIV, you're in big trouble, if not going to heaven, right? So he said, we have to invent something to protect the hospital. I said, all right, Martin, I'll think about it. But I must say he persists and called me every month. I said, all right, let me think about this. This is terrible because, 20,000 accidental needle sticks. Now, first, how does this happen? You know Murphy's Law, right? Do you know Schultz's Law? How many people here know Schultz's Law? Nobody. Schultz's Law is that Murphy's Law is optimistic. Okay? That's how it happens, okay? Anyway, so I thought about it, and I said, wait a minute. I got it. The long little thing that I did, when you see it, it's very simple. It's known as an eccentric hole on a little disc. Anyway, to make a long story short, invented it, got a patent, went to Becton Dickinson. They said, oh, this is great. Anyway, to make a long story, it made millions of dollars in royalties. Okay, I don't know what Becton Dickinson made, hundreds of million dollars. As a matter of fact, I think I just spoke to Martin a few hours ago. I think we're down to we got one more payment of royalties to go, okay? And then my patent expires because patents don't last forever. And there it is, it's gone. But why am I proud of that? If that prevented one person from getting AIDS and dying, if it saved one life, it's a great thing because in Judaism we have, he who saves one life saves the world. So that I'm most proud of. Forget about the money it made. I mean, it all went to charity for me anyway. And I gave him 25% of the royalty, so he was very, very happy. But anyway, it may have saved one life. I'm delighted.
And many more than that. There's one other invention that I think is really quite wonderful. And it's because people are becoming, you know, more interested in eating well. You know, it goes back to, you know, the old Tiny Tim thing about you are what you eat and the rest of it. Why don't you just say a word about the evening that you went and had dinner and you said, well, this looks good, except the problem is it's white rice and this is all going to turn into sugar and I want to be well. And so tell us that story, because it's really
wonderful. Actually, it's sort of, I have some cousins who live in Panama, and they came to visit me in San Francisco, and Henry's wife, Frida, decided to make me a dish. She said, you got to try this dish, very popular in the Middle East. I said, okay. I said, what is it? It's white rice and lentils. Very popular in the Middle East. Okay. I said, I won't eat this. He said, why not? I said, I don't eat white rice. But I said, well, give me the recipe, blah, blah. So I said, okay. I went out and bought brown rice and made it too with brown rice. I'm free to taste this. Oh, this is much better. I'll never use white rice again. So again, sometimes you've got to demonstrate to get something to click. If I just tell her, use brown rice, she's okay. But I said, no, I'll make it with brown rice. Now you can taste it with it. And being an experimenter, I kept experimenting. And we made a product. I made a product which I call Sufu, which is super food. It's sold in Whole Foods, Molly Stone's.
I mean, Drager's.
We have not had one supermarket refuse to put it on. It's got 9 grains. But the interesting thing is, there's not one rice recipe that I know that uses whole wheat berries in the formula. We use whole wheat berries and we use whole rye berries. And it gives it a crunch. I think it's a delicious food. It's available at Whole Foods. It's called Sufu, S-O-O-F-O-O, for super food. And it's terrific, high protein, you know, all that stuff. And it's organic, okay? No pesticides, genetic modification. It's very good food. Anyway, it's available, and it's healthy. And I like things that are healthy and delicious.
So,
and if you want to serve it for breakfast for your kids,
put
add
maple
some maple syrup,
or
brown sugar. Kids want it sweet. And it's a hell of a lot better than Cheerios, and a lot better for the kid than Cheerios.
So, and has Frida begun? Because she could be your agent in Panama for the sale of Sufu.
I hope so.
Yeah.
She
hasn't sold
one package in Panama. But.
Okay. But I think what's interesting, because it's not just the invention of things, but it's carrying through the entire process. As I recall from the book, you actually went to different markets. You had people trying it so that you had people...
No, well, I hired a person to go sell it. I said, how are you going to sell this? I will show the buyer. This is a great... it's got 9 grains, and it has protein, and it has its organic... I said, that's it? Yeah, I think he'll buy it. I says, no. I said, I want you to buy a wide-mouth thermos. I want you to cook it in the morning, take it to the buyer and say, here it is, it's got all this protein. I said, but I want you to taste it, Mr. Buyer. Open again, have a little paper cup, put it in there, I said, taste it. Oh, yeah, we'll put it in. Okay? It's as simple as doing that, which changes the whole picture.
Exactly.
Okay? Because you just show it and tell us, yeah, or we'll think about it. Goodbye. Let them taste it. And we'd like to have tastings. And we have tastings, and people, I'll take it. Okay, Ted Danson was there. He said, oh, Mr. Danson. No, please, just say, all right, I'll take it. I'll take 2 packs, you know. And then again, it's all based on management. So I say to the guys, all right, I said, Mrs. Jones buys a Sufu. Now what? What happened? Oh, we say, thank you very much, Mrs. Jones. He says, are you crazy? First of all, just have a little brochure and say, madam, we would like your input. If you have recipes, if you've added strawberries or chicken liver or whatever, we want to hear from you. Get involved, okay? Tell your friends about it, you know. You morons. I mean, if I tell you, Sometimes I think I'm surrounded by idiots, but anyway.
No. You never know. No, Maurice. No, it's interesting. In the back of the book, when you're talking about social media and all, and noting that, you know, inventions like Facebook can be very helpful because you can have people go and post recipes and get into little competitions and the rest.
Terrific. Yes.
Okay, so some people want to know, since they know you're a very successful inventor, if people come to you with inventions that they'd like you to back, how do you respond?
Well, again, if somebody thinks he has something that is an invention, I mean, it could be 15 years old, go on the web and check to see if there's such an invention out there. Describe your invention. I mean, I think any 15-year-old can do this for you. So then you can say, well, there's no such invention, okay, applied for or issued. Now, you say, what do you do now? Make a model of it. Don't just tell me I want to do this. Show me what it looks like. With today, you've got 3D printing or 3D model making. You can have something made for very little money to show what it is. It could be a new towel holder. I don't know, whatever it is. Try to make a sample. Try to say, now this, if we can produce this commercially, I know this will sell and blah, blah. Okay. And, of course, apply for a patent.
So somebody wants to know, and I don't, let me just raise the question. What do you think of Tesla's releasing its patents?
Well, first, in terms of the, there's not, look, you say Tesla or electric cars running, no pollution. Well, wait a minute. You've got to manufacture electricity. And in order to manufacture, most of the electricity manufactured is still using coal. And that puts a lot of carbon dioxide in the air. So I say, Mr. Musk, Elon Musk, I said, this doesn't come without pollution. Yeah, riding the car in the city does not create pollution, but somebody's got to create the electricity. Oh, we're going to use solar panels. Well, you're going to have a whole lot of solar panels if you've got 1,000 cars. Okay, you've got acres and acres of, so it's not that easy. I am praying that we are able to harness the power of fusion. Right now, any of the atomic plants are doing fission, which produces radioactive waste. If we had fusion, there would be no radioactive waste, and we could produce huge quantities of electricity, okay? And it would change the world, because what we would do is take that electricity and put it into water and disassociate H2O into H and O. The O we let go, the hydrogen we put into cylinders. That will run a car with a $400 conversion. Hydrogen will run a car. And when the hydrogen burns, what do we get? Water vapor. Okay? Fabulous. I hope it happens tomorrow, okay? Right now, we have not yet been able to control a fusion reaction so that we can create heat to make steam, to run generators, to create electricity. And I'm praying that happens.
You know, we've reached the point in the program where there's time for only one last question. And so many people have noted that you've been this wonderful, successful inventor, but that you are also a very committed philanthropist.
Okay.
And I'd like you to just say a word about how you feel about this. Your brother Elliot said you should stop working because, you know, what are you working
to
for?
To do what?
What are you working for? And your response is, you know, I'm not working to make money because everything I make, I give away.
Yeah.
But I think part of that stems from your wonderful background, your family, tradition.
Well, you know, and
repairing the world.
Well, I grew up with, you know, there's more on your plate than you can consume. Find someone who's hungry, okay? And I'm saying here the poor people can't get eyeglasses. Well, now you're for 85 cents. The guy can see. Or a 10-year-old at school that can't see the blackboard. Oh, my God, I could see. And it's so simple. You know, it's not rocket science and so inexpensive. So if I could do something that does good, I'm delighted, you know. Look, both my parents died of heart attack. They never suffered like cancer. They died in their sleep, okay? So I said, nothing would please me more if people made some tremendous advances in cardiac problems and also had treatment and whatnot. So I'd give money to the, you know, cardiac center, heart center. I give a lot of money for research, for instance. The one research product that I hope will succeed, they're doing research and trying to create a superconductor. I said, what the hell's a superconductor? Who needs it? Well, it's very simple. It's not complicated. If we generate electricity in Los Angeles and then send it to San Francisco, by the time it gets here, we've lost at least 25% of electricity in the transportation because the conductor is not a superconductor. But if we had a superconductor where you can transport electricity through a conductor without losses, we could generate electricity in Victoria Falls and send it to Europe. Again, it would change the world. And at night in New York, well, you know, they would send it here. It's still daylight, you know. So you, different time zones. Anyway, it would change the world. So I support that. And I'm making some progress. Okay? They're not even using metal now. They've got a nylon cord that looks like a tennis string, nylon tennis string, you know. But they've impacted it with microscopic nanoparticles of carbon, and it's conducting. It is not a superconductor, but it's conducting.
With progress.
And we're waiting for a miracle. It's like, people don't know this, but 1947, three guys at Bell Labs were fooling around with a disc of silicone, and it was a non-conductor, okay? And one of them said, well, let's try to pass a current across the... It passed a small current. It became a conductor. There in the name semiconductor. Okay? Then there goes the transistor. It changed the world. Now, I understand the transistor. What I don't understand is how in God's name can you put 2 million transistors on a half-inch chip? Mind-boggling. So I don't understand everything, okay?
All right. Let me just say, ladies and gentlemen,
I don't know.
We express deep appreciation to our guest, Maurice Kanbar, inventor, philanthropist, and author of the newly updated version of his 2001 book, Secrets from an Inventor's Notebook. We thank our audiences here and on the radio, television, and internet. Let me remind those of you here this evening that copies of Maurice's book are on sale in the lobby, and he'll be pleased to sign books outside this room immediately following the program. We'd also appreciate your letting him go down this aisle so that he can make his way to the signing table as quickly as possible. I'm Mary Bitterman, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place to be in the know, is adjourned. Okay.